There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
It's a Dubai Eye 103.8 special.
Broadcasting live from the 2018 Emirates Airline Festival of Literature for the Love of Words.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Right now, I'm joined by international best-selling author of many award-winning novels, including his Detective Superintendent Rory Grace series, set in Brighton. They've been translated into 37 languages with worldwide sales of over 18 million copies. I am, of course, talking about Peter James. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Annabelle.
Last time you were on the show, we were talking about the books that you take with you if you were stranded to a desert island. Can you remind us what those were?
It's the books that I would miss not taking. The ones I would take is definitely Brighton Rock. I would take Slaughterhouse-Five, Kurt Vonnegut Jr., because it's a book that would always cheer me up. I read that book for the first time in my kind of early 20s, and he's got some wonderful wisdom in it, apart from the humor, and things like, as a character who says, I don't know what's going on, and I guess I'm not smart enough to understand if someone to explain it to me. I think we're being tested by someone or something a whole lot bigger than us, and all I can do is hang around and try and be calm and friendly and have a nice time till it's over.
One thing that often strikes me is not many people get the opportunity to actually meet some of their heroes, but you did. You got the opportunity to actually speak to Kurt Vonnegut, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I was at film school when I read Slaughterhouse-Five, and I just thought, I want to make this a film movie. And I got into directory inquiries, and I found his name in the phone book in Martha's Vineyard, and I phoned it.
How old were you at the time?
I was 21 at the time.
Okay.
And I didn't know that things were impossible, and you didn't do things that way. And he answered. And I just couldn't believe I was talking to this man. I'd read everything he'd written at that time, and he was like, one of my big heroes, and he was charming. He said, I'm real sorry, sir. I actually sold the film rights, but I tell you what, I'll take your phone number. If they never make the movie, I'll call you back and see if the rights come available then.
One thing that I did want to bring up was the fact that you've contributed a piece to For the Love of Words, which is this lovely anthology that Motivate Publishing have produced. 84 authors have contributed to it, and it's about the love of each of these authors, the love they have for words. And I did wonder where your love of words began, particularly whether you fell in love with crime writing all at once or whether it was more of a gradual process.
I kind of always wanted to be a writer ever since I was about 7. I remember reading Enid Blyton. I was one of those irritating guys who kind of constantly writing letters to my favourite authors. And I wrote to Enid Blyton. I said, "Dear Miss Blyton, I've just read 5 Go to Treasure Island, and they've spent 7 days on this island, and the one of them's gone to the toilet in all that time, and I'm really worried." And she wrote a very sweet letter back, saying, well, they had gone, but she didn't think little boys and girls were interested in those things, so she left them. Anyhow, I used to love just certain expressions, certain sentences, would kind of phrases would stick in my mind. And I wanted to be an author, and I read there was a shortage of spy thrillers, and I thought, well, I could write a spy thriller, so I did. I wrote one called Dead Letter Drop, and to my amazement it got published in 1981. To my even bigger amazement, it didn't sell. But we got burgled just after the book had come out, and I just got married. And a young detective came to the house to take fingerprints, and he saw my book, and he said, if you want any research help from the police, give me a call.
Mm.
And my then wife and I became friendly with him, and he was married to a detective. And through him, I started meeting other police officers across the whole spectrum. Homicide, detectives, traffic, response, childhood protection, neighborhood policing. And I found these people fascinating. And I began to realize that I wanted to write thrillers, but I also wanted to write very much and try about making sense of the world in which we live, because I think that's a big role of authors. And as I got to know more and more police officers, and they trusted me, they started inviting me to go out and patrol with them. And one day, I did a 12-hour shift with a duty inspector, and we started at 7 o'clock in the morning with a cop death, which is incredibly traumatic. There's a young couple, their 3-month-old baby's died during the night. The police have to give them kind of support, pastoral care, but also be mindful. They might have murdered that baby. So it's a crime scene. really difficult wire to. And an hour later, we're at a horrific domestic abuse situation. Another hour later, an elderly couple have just been swindled out of their life savings by an online fraudster. And the day goes on. And I started to realize that nobody sees more of human life in a 30-year career than a police officer. Mm. And that was a starting point for me in terms of writing crime. I write crime, okay, because it gives me an opportunity to write real thrills and spills and page turners, but I write it above all because I don't think there's any other way that I could have such insights into human nature.
One thing that I have noticed from reading your novels is the attention to detail as to how a police station works and who is responsible for what and how you go into a crime scene. And all the kind of level of detail that I haven't necessarily found in other books or crime shows. What was the most difficult... you mentioned the cot death was particularly difficult for the police to handle, but what's one particular crime scene that sticks in your mind as being very difficult to sort of write and get to grips with?
I think, fun enough, it was the one that actually inspired my Need You Dead. Mm. And it wasn't actually, I didn't actually visit the crime scene. I was sitting in Los Angeles with the emergency controller, and this call came in, going back about 6 years, hysterical woman. She said her ex was trying to break into the house, and she was barricaded herself in an upstairs room, and you could hear the sort of bang, bang, bang as he was bashing down the door. And the caller said, you know, there's a car on the way. Can you lock your bedroom door? You know, put something against it. And we heard blam, blam, blam. And she screams, he's coming in, he's coming in. The door's caving in. And the next thing is we heard five shots, and she'd been shot dead. And I listened to that, and I was just traumatized by it afterwards. And I thought, I have to write this scene. But it took me 5 years before I could actually be enough distance from it. And so I've used it as a sort of, as a part of Need You Dead, and I think it really can help. And I think, for me, authenticity is in research is so important, because I think that everyone who reads, well, the fact they're reading books means they're intelligent. Mm-hmm. And I think when we read, we don't just want chewing gum for the eyes, I call it, just a story that the baddies got caught and end up. I think when we read, we want to learn about the human condition, about life, about stuff, and I think that, you know, the most important thing in writing is character. We read books first and foremost to find out what happens to characters we engage with, but the set equally important is research, because if you don't believe that the author knows what he or she is writing about, you're going to lose interest pretty quickly. Mm. And also, I find from research, it's critically important. The police is a very Around the world, police forces are very fast-moving organizations. They are constantly changing. And I try really hard to keep up, to keep current. In my next Roy Grace book, I've got bitcoins being used for a kidnap ransom, because that is what's being used. And so all the time, neither crime stands still, nor criminals, nor the police.
So that new crime novel that you're writing, that's another Roy Grace novel. It's called Dead If You Don't?
Dead If You Don't.
And when is it going to be out?
It's going to be out in May 17th.
So we still have a little bit to wait.
Yeah.
One thing that you mentioned there was character being incredibly important. And I wondered if Roy Grace was moulded on anyone in particular that you've met over the years.
He is absolutely moulded on a real life character called Dave Gaylor. And I first met Dave in 1995. The police I was going out with said, you might like to meet this guy. He's quite a quirky homicide detective. So I go in this guy's office, and I've never seen an office with such a tip. It was just covered in blue and green plastic crates, piled 6 foot high, full of folders, and his head just visible behind them. And I said, oh, are you moving? He said, oh, no, these are my dead friends. And I thought, oh, great, he's a weirdo here. And he laughed, and he said, I'm a homicide detective, but I've also just been tasked with reopening all the unsolved murders, 37 in the county of Sussex, where there's somebody still alive who could benefit from the investigation. He said, each one of these crates contains the principal case file of an unsolved murder. I am the last chance the victim has for justice, and that their family has for closure. And I suddenly saw this extraordinary human image of him. And he said to me, you know, what are you writing at the moment? And I was writing a thriller called Denial. He said, tell me about it. So I started telling him. He said, hang on a sec, your character wouldn't have done that. Why has your detective not got an outside inquiry team doing this? And why is this character not doing it? And I thought, wow, this guy's got a really creative streak to him. And long story short, we became good mates, and he rose up to the ranks, and in 2002 he became Detective Chief Superintendent, Head of Major Crime for Sussex. When my publishers asked me if I'd ever thought of creating a detective as a central character, so I went to Dave and I said, how would you like to be a fictional cop? And he loved it, and we worked together on every Roy Grace novel. We have a particular table in a pub where we sit and plan with a new Moleskine notebook.
Yeah.
He reads every 100 pages, tells me how Roy would think and act. And today he's my best mate. When I got married again 3 years ago, he was best man. And it's just been an extraordinary relationship, and it's helped me to get that authenticity that is so important for my writing.
What struck me there was when you said that, you know, he kind of saw himself, or he did see himself as these victims' last chance for justice. And I think that level of caring, of compassion, really comes across in Roy Grace, in that character in your books. But he's not just unique in that respect. You included a mystery in his own life from the beginning of the novels, didn't you? Tell us about that.
Yes, when I created the character Roy Grace, and I had the wonderful model of Dave Gaylor, but I thought, you know, what? There's a big cliche in fictional detectives that, you know, you have a drink problem and a broken marriage.
Mm.
And the reality is, in the British police today, any police officer with a drink problem wouldn't last 24 hours. They'd be out when they happen. And I thought, what detectives do more than anything else is they solve puzzles. And I felt it would be an interesting slant to give my detective a private puzzle of his own that he couldn't solve. So when we first meet Roy Grace in Dead Simple, he's coming up to his 39th birthday, and we learn that 9 years earlier, on his 30th birthday, his wife, Sandy, who he loved and adored, just vanished off the face of the earth. And he's been looking for her for 9 years. He doesn't know whether she was murdered, abducted, ran off with a lover. And whilst he functions as an effective homicide detective, all that time he's still dogged. He's in tries to go to mediums, dogged by the mystery. And in each of the books in the series, I seed a little bit more in about what might have happened.
And by the point of Need You Dead, which is the latest one that's currently out, we've already found out what's happened to his wife, which I'm not going to give any spoilers, but that's not where the mystery ends. There's still more, which I think is quite interesting. You've managed to still continue that for him.
Yeah, it's almost like there's closure on one, and it's opened yet another kind of Russian doll door. And I'm having fun with that. I think... I love the idea of teasing readers in books. You know, I think as long as you do it legitimately. I mean, I remember when Dead Simple came out, I'd set up the mystery of Roy Grace's missing wife, and I was going to give the answer to what happened in the second book, in Looking Good Dead. And Dead Simple came out, and I was inundated with emails from readers speculating on what might have happened to Sandy. And I thought, you know what, I can have some fun with this. And I've had some wonderful letters over the years. I had an email a couple of years back. Dear Mr. James, I've just worked out that I'm a lot younger than you, and I imagine I'm much fitter, which means you're going to die before me. So I hope you've left a secret of what happened to Sandy safely in your publisher's vaults.
That's not a very nice way of saying it. But I love that your fans orchestrated their own torture effectively, which I think is brilliant. We were talking earlier about your Desert Island reads that you chose when you were on the show a couple of weeks ago. And you mentioned Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. You mentioned Brighton Rock by Graham Greene. And one that we haven't talked about yet was the fact that you chose The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris. There we go. And this brings me to a question about villains. And you do an incredible amount of research, and I think this extends to the inspiration for the villains in your novels. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I'm fascinated by villains, as I think we all are, because most villains do not have "I'm a serial killer" tattooed on their forehead. The really dangerous ones are just blended into the community. You know, the worst serial killer we had in England, Harold Shipman, nice family doctor, just happened to like killing his patients.
They're often charming, aren't they?
Charming, you know, and so often when a serial killer's arrested, there's a television crew filming the next door neighbour who's a little old lady who says, oh, he's such a nice man, he used to feed my cat.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of talks in prisons trying to encourage literacy, but it also gives me the opportunity, of course, to mingle with many, and sometimes I'll come across somebody who's just a gem in terms of a character. And my two books back, my book Love You Dead, was inspired by this. There was a woman in the woman's prison I was giving a talk to, And she was asking really smart questions about literature, and I thought, I wonder what you're in for. And I made a beeline for her. And afterwards, and I said, well, yeah, I never say what brought you in here. I'll say, how much longer do you have to go? And she looked at me and said, 9.5 more blooming years, and it's just not fair. The woman did exactly what I did in London. She's only got 6 more years. I said, oh, you know, what brought you in there? She said, well, I poisoned my mother-in-law, the old bag. I said, really? She said, well, the thing was, she went in the hospital to die, so I embezzled her bank account. Bloody woman didn't die. She came back home. And I realised she'd find out what I'd done, so I had to poison her. Then I realised my husband would find out, so I had to poison him too, and it's just not fair. This woman did exactly what I did in London. She's only got 6 more years. And I was being taken out by the officer. I said, is this for real? Oh, yes, sir. Husband was 3 months on life support. He's got permanent brain damage, and she's just angry about a sentence. I thought, you have to be a character in a future book of mine.
You've met some really interesting characters and villainous people in real life. And you were talking earlier about the fact that when you were following the police around getting research for your books, there was one in particular where you heard the shots fired, that it took you 5 years to digest that and to actually turn that into a book. Do you ever get so close to some of these people or so involved that you actually need to retreat and kind of do something else and distract yourself?
Yes, I've met a number of villains who've kind of really quite scared me. One who's a kind of career bank robber who's shot one person dead, and I want to bring him in as a character, but it's still quite raw. I mean, he's just actually quite scary because of his complete lack of any guilt. I said to him, I had lunch with him a few months ago, I said, you know, you're 58 years old, you're broke, you know, what's the biggest success you've ever had? He said, I got 50,000 quid in a raid about 18 years ago. I said, what'd you do with the money? He said, rented a big suite at the Metropole in Brighton, lodged it for 6 months. And I said, you've got 5 kids scattered around the world. You've never had a relationship lasting longer than 2 years. You've spent more of your life in jail than out. You're 58 now, living in a bedsit in Brighton. If you could live your life over, what would you do different? Oh, do it all again. It's your adrenaline, you see.
I find it funny that you find that is actually more scary when you meet those people in person than some of the serial killers that you've met.
I think it was because with him it was like a career choice. Be good or be bad. With the serial killers, they are equally terrifying in their kind of own ways. But some people just touch you. You feel in the presence of evil. Yeah. And I think there is palpable evil in the world.
I've spoken quite a bit about the Roy Grace novels, and I do have one last question on that, and it goes back to your writing process. Now, you've got how many novels in the Roy Grace series now?
14.
I have a very basic question. How do you keep continuity over all those novels?
Luckily, computers. we have a series Bible, and a person in my publisher is dedicated to making sure that that Norman Potting's car colour doesn't change over 5 books or every detail like that. And it is hard, but I love doing it as well. I feel like every time I start a new Roy Grace novel and returning to my family, I'll say hi, you know, hi Norman, who've you upset this week?
I did tell a bit of a fib. I've got one more question about the Roy Grace novels, and that goes back to the setting of Brighton, and that's your hometown. It's very important to you, and also has quite a criminal history. And does that bear some relation to the fact that Brighton Rock is one of your desert island novels as well? It's clearly a very important place to you.
Brighton is a wonderful place for me, firstly because it's got a massive criminal history. I mean, in 1932, it was called the crime capital of the UK and the murder capital of Europe. And it's never really changed. You can thank the London-Brighton railway line, which opened in 1841, bringing all the villains down from London to the seaside. Much nicer place to be a villain. And they brought everything with them. Cockfighting, prostitution, protection racketeering. And they never went away.
And it was quite a hub for smuggling as well.
Bright Helmstone, back in the Middle Ages, so it's riddled with tunnels, passages. It's always had that kind of dark criminal underbelly, which is, I think, what gives it an edge.
Do you sometimes need a break from writing Roy Grace, though?
Yes, I've written several standalones, and I have a new standalone coming out this autumn called Absolute Proof, which is very different to Roy Grace. It's a book I've been working on since 1989.
Wow.
And it's a thriller on the topic of what would happen if somebody credible claimed to have absolute proof of God's existence. I've written it in a kind of Dan Brown-y, I don't like to say that word, but that kind of a big canvas thriller. But I had a phone call out the blue in 1989, elderly sounding guy saying, is that Peter James, the author? That was before I was ex-directory, and I said, yes. He said, I'm not a lunatic. I was a Fleet Air Arm pilot in the war. I have been given absolute proof of God's existence, and I've been told you're the man to help me get taken seriously. He said, my name is Harry Nixon, and I said, do you want to tell me a bit more about this? And he said, I need to come see you. I'm going to need 4 days of your time. I said, whoa, hang on a second. I'm pretty busy. What's this about? He said, well, my wife recently died of cancer, and before she died, we agreed I'd go to a medium and try and contact her. And I did this. Instead of my wife coming through, a male came through who said, as a representative of God, God was extremely concerned about the state of the world and felt that if man could have faith in him reaffirmed, it would get us back on an even keel. And as proof of his bona fides, he's given me 3 pieces of information nobody on earth knows. And he said, there's an author called Peter James who'll help me get taken seriously. Long story short, I asked him if he'd checked any of these coordinates out. He said, yes. He said, I've located the Holy Grail. It's a chalice well in Glastonbury. And Glastonbury's run by a group of trustees. And I've applied to do an archaeological dig, but they won't take me seriously. But I think they would take you seriously. Anyhow, I went to see a friend of mine who at that time was Bishop of Reading. And I said, you know, what would be your view if somebody could absolutely prove God existed beyond doubt? He said, I think they'd be murdered, because whose God would it be? Is it going to be the Protestant God, Anglican God, Catholic, Judaic, Islamic, Sikh? And you've got all the countries like China, communist countries, Russia, who would not want a higher power usurping them. I thought, I've got my story.
And on that bombshell, believe it or not, that's where we have to leave it. So when is Absolute Proof out?
It's coming out October the 4th.
October 4th. Thank you so much, Peter James, for joining us on Talking Books. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.